Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming for the first time in months from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. If you'd like to watch today's program, you can go to ustream.tv, search for Gary Null Show. That's U-S-T-R-E-A-M-TV. And that way you can see our new studios. We have two beautiful studios here in New York City, just completed. And today we have a lot of information. We're going to start, of course, as we always do, with the latest on health and healing. I'm going to challenge the paleo diet, which I've done on several other occasions, but using good quality historical and anthropological information of why it's nonsense. Then we're going to talk about eating a lot of fish may help curb depression risk. And this is from the British Medical Journal and the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. Also, we're going to talk about how the Mediterranean diet plus olive oil reduces breast cancer risk from the University of Navarra in Spain, also published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. How sleeping long frequently is due to having too much copper. Well, that's not good, from the University of Eastern Finland, and what to do about it. Then I will do an original white paper, an investigative report. Monsanto sealed documents reveal the truth behind Roundup's toxicological dangers. This is a in-depth original report with Richard Gale, scholar in residence, and myself. It is now being posted on the Progressive Radio Network. My suggestion is that for lawyers in the audience, read it. It can withstand cross-examination in a trial. This has been reviewed by the scientists involved, and they have signed off that all the statements in this original report are accurate. Our attorneys have reviewed it. So we believe that this will open the door to massive litigation. Why? Because for the first time, I will reveal in detail that Monsanto knew or should have known that its glyphosate, the most commonly used pesticide in the world, was causing cancers in all types of studies, not just one or two, in many. I'll review those studies and what has been found. In my personal opinion, this is actually exceeding in importance the information from the whistleblower about Big Tobacco having known for a long time that tobacco was addictive and was dangerous. But until he blew the whistle, until they had to apologize, the tobacco industry had never lost a lawsuit showing that tobacco smoking caused either emphysema or cancer. They had hired a lot of famous doctors and scientists to be their mouthpieces. I believe that the same could be said for genetic engineering. So this is historic. Then something else is historic is later today, after following that program discussion, you will hear the beginning of Occupy Peace. I am not a big supporter of Occupy Wall Street for a lot of reasons I've discussed in the past. I believe that many of the people involved in it were very immature politically. They demeaned and denied the virtue of all former protest movements that had, through decades of trial and error and through great human sacrifice, had taught us something about protest, how they work or don't work. And just the fact that you can show up with some people and say that you're against something doesn't cause any real change. But now there is a group of people who are very mature, very politically savvy, who are starting a movement called Occupy Peace, Gerald Salante and Dr. Paul Craig Roberts and Ralph Nader will be on the program today discussing this, and I'll be joining them for a conference to launch all this weekend in Kingston. So we are going to talk today about how the U.S. should move towards a nation promoting global peace instead of conflict and war, hence Occupy Peace. As you see, we have a lot to discuss. Let's begin. First up, every 2 or 3 years, there's a new gimmick, a new diet craze. Remember the Atkins diet? Well, Robert Atkins was a longtime personal friend of mine. In many respects, I have a lot of respect for him because Bob was not afraid to go up against the medical community. In fact, we toured together doing press conferences challenging the FDA and its siding with Big Pharma. But on diet, we were at completely opposite ends. I was promoting veganism and a plant-based diet. He was promoting huge consumption of animal proteins and mainly what you would now call paleo diet, very little carbs, some berries, and meat, all you wanted to meat and fat. Unfortunately, it was not a healthy diet. The body has no way of storing protein. So if you gorge on a protein, no matter why you like it, a big hot dog or hamburger or barbecued ribs, you're taking in more protein than what the body can actually process through the liver, the kidneys, and there's no way to store it. So then you end up with a byproduct, and the byproduct is urea, also ammonium, which is toxic to the kidney cells. And that's why people on these high-protein diets frequently have problems with their kidneys, their liver, and also their blood. This is the latest on the paleo diet, why I'm opposed to it. I believe it's nothing more than a fad. There's no science behind it, in my opinion. This is from Tracy Watson from the National Geographic. Quote, ancient oat discovery may poke more holes in paleo diet. Maybe the paleo diet should include a nice warm bowl of oatmeal. Strict followers of the fashionable caveman regimen shun starchy foods, sticking to breakfast such as cold halibut with fruit and snacks of pork chops and celery. Bread, pasta, and potatoes are verboten. Our Stone Age ancestors didn't gorge themselves on grains or other starchy fare, the thinking goes, and neither should we. But now evidence has emerged that people enjoying their carbs, even during the Paleolithic era, a period also known as the Old Stone Age, that stretched from roughly 2.5 million to 12,000 years ago, a new analysis of a Paleolithic pestle shows it was dusted with oat starch, suggesting that ancient humans were grinding oats into flour and presumably dining on oat cakes or some other oat-based delicacy. This discovery is the latest challenge to the notion that prehistoric people fueled up with berries and venison while foraging grains and other starchy carbs. Scientists still debate what exactly our forebears ate, and he goes on to discuss this. Quote, the idea that prehistoric people didn't eat grain is just wrong. It's misinformed, says Hugh Barton of Britain's University of Leicester, who studies ancient starch grains. Quote, people ate what they could get their hands on, eating to survive. Survival may have hinged on oats some 33,000 years ago at the Italian cave called Grotta Pagliacci. Inside the cave, archaeologists have uncovered paintings and what must have been a cherished tool, a sandstone pestle, and it was studded with starch granules from a cornucopia of plant materials, including grasses similar to millet and acorns, and this was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and also oats. And eating oats during the Paleolithic wouldn't have been an easy thing. They would have had to collect the oats and cook them in some way. But they did. So this, by the way, is the third time I have seen studies on the foods in the paleo diet. just remember, you couldn't store anything unless it was dried. You were scavenging, and people tended to stay in one place as long as there was adequate food in that place. The idea that you would go out and hunt every day was a misnomer. People didn't do that. They would gorge on whatever they found. So if it was berries, they would gorge on berries. If it was seeds or nuts, they would gorge on them. And as they would develop fire, as they could cook things, they found that they could expand their diet based upon using water, heat, and the processing of something through hydrolysis, which, like, make a porridge. So it wasn't just a meat and berry diet. And the intestines, intestinal content and stool content has been examined and has proven this. So once again, we have good science challenging good marketing. And more often than not, good marketing wins the day. So you'll have another big best-selling phenomena of paleo diet books and foods and marketing. But the reality is that when you go eating meat and animal proteins, you're contributing to global warming. You're also contributing to disease because meat is a dead item. It has no intrinsic life force. But grains, nuts, seeds, legumes, tubers, fibers, fruits and vegetables, and herbs do. In fact, at the Institute of Applied Biology, where I was a senior research scholar and scientist, I was the one doing the research, and the only one doing research on nutrition and aging. And I was the one who found that all plant-based foods contain all 8 essential amino acids. I wrote a paper on this. It was published in a peer-reviewed journal. Plus, I wrote a textbook on this called The Egg Project. And it was called The Egg Project because the egg was considered up to that point the most perfectly utilized form of protein. In point of fact, we found combinations in commonly edible foods that exceeded the egg. Hence, replacing the egg is the most perfect form of protein. Hence, those of us who are vegan, who have nothing with a face or heartbeat, no animal flesh nor diet, we are consuming foods that are higher in fiber, hence preventing a lot of diseases of the intestine. We are also living longer lives. All the major studies show that a healthy vegan diet, you live about 9 years longer, but can live much longer than that if you're also using supplements and exercising and de-stressing. You're also having a greater nutrient concentration with less calories, which means that you are going to live longer because every study shows that the less calories consumed to the actual needs of the body, meaning getting your calories you need, but don't get excessive calories, your body lives longer. Hence, fasting, even periodic fasting, even partial fasting, to have a protein shake 3 times on a Sunday with juices throughout the day, that's a form of fasting. You're not over-concentrating calories in the diet, you live longer. This is what all the studies show. In fact, I did a study. In 1974, I did a study for 2 years where I took one group of laboratory rats, 1,000, and I gave them just the standard rat chow and the same environment. Another group, I fasted them, and they did not eat the same amount of calories. Plus, I also didn't give them water. I gave them fresh-made juices. A third group, I gave living foods. There was nothing heated, cooked, or processed at all. Now, the group that get the standard chow, they lived their normal lives and died. The group that was fasted and given juices instead of water, they lived 25% longer. But the group that was given living foods, fresh grains and sprouted grains and all the normal foods, but given in their raw state, they live longer still by almost 10%. Then changing the environment, letting them not live in cages, but letting them live in the whole space and giving them challenges each day and playing meditative music. All of this contributed to longevity. And each study had to last full length of the animals so you could lifespan of the animals, so you could see what makes a difference. Now, compare that to a human. Put a human in a tiny little office, a little boxed office with no light, no views of nature. Then put someone around nature where they have sounds and sights and smells of nature, they do much better. They heal quicker. It's even been shown in hospitals, those facing a wall having the same post-operative experience as someone who's facing a park. The ones facing a park, watching trees and watching weather, they heal faster than those who don't. But the treatment's identical. So our environment makes a difference. The music we listen to makes a difference. Is it agitating? Is it exciting? Is it calming? Is it soothing? The stress levels we're under. Do we relax when we eat? I like to eat in silence. I suggest others try it. So you really put your energy into grounding yourself, being open and relaxed in that moment. Also, to exercise every day, to get that body moving, at least every 2 hours to get up and do some exercise, just walking, doing half squats, doing something, pushing against your body against a wall with your hands and fingers on the wall, that strengthens and relaxes by contraction and relaxation, the muscles in your back, your arms, to do some sit-ups, to do some push-ups. Even if you did it for a minute, you're helping. So all these are pieces to the puzzle. What is not a piece to the puzzle is a meat-based diet, like the paleo diet. Because for every one of those animals that you are eating, you're taking in more protein than what your body needs or can use. That contributes to some degree to your disease process. Men and women who have a meat-based diet have a higher incidence of breast cancer, uterine cancer, colon cancer, and prostate cancer. You're also contributing to methane. Methane is 20 times, that's 2,000% more deadly to global warming than CO2. And right now, we are in a catastrophic situation as far as our environmental temperatures. So becoming a vegan, a plant-based diet, you're contributing individually to helping the planet. So that's my thought on that. Now, from the British Medical Journal, also published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health, eating, quote, eating a lot of fish may help curb the risk of depression. The association between fish diet and mental health appears to be equally significant among men and women. The depression affects, quote, 315 million people worldwide and is projected to become the second leading cause of ill health in the next 4 years. Several previous studies have looked at the possible role of dietary factors in modifying depression risk, but the findings have been inconsistent and conclusive. The researchers therefore pulled the data from relevant studies and came up with this. There were 101 different studies which showed the benefits. They looked at 150,000 participants. So here's my thoughts. You do not have to be on a fish-based diet unless you choose to be in order to help with depression. What you're really looking at are the essential fatty acids. And we do know, there's ample studies, the DHA, one of the important fractions of the fatty acids, will help with depression. It is a great mood modulator. It helps you if you're depressed. It helps you if you're anxious. DHA. So if you have the omega-3 fatty acids, you can help yourself with depression. However, why have fish when you can have flaxseed oil or walnuts? They're equally good because they also have a very usable form of the omega-3 fatty acids. Or simply take a supplement, a vegan supplement, which is easy and inexpensive to get, of 1,500 milligrams of the omega-3 fatty acids to help yourself with depression. It's that simple. And finally, from the University of Navarra in Spain, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine, the Mediterranean diet plus olive oil is associated with a reduced breast cancer risk. Quote, breast cancer is a frequently diagnosed cancer and a leading cause of death in women. Diet has been extensively studied as a modifying risk factor in the development of breast cancer, but epidemiological evidence on the effect of specific dietary factors is inconsistent. The Mediterranean diet is known for its abundance of plant foods, fish, and especially olive oil. Dr. Gonzalez, MD, of the University of Navarra, and research team analyzed the effects of two interventions with the Mediterranean diet and supplementing with extra virgin olive oil or nuts, and compared with advice to women to follow a low-fat diet. And then they looked at, they had 15 grams of walnuts and hazelnuts, which is not a lot, by the way. Remember, that's 1 ounce. That's small. The study was conducted within the framework of the large PREDIMED study, and they did it over a six-year period on 4,200 women at high risk for cardiovascular disease, and then a group that were not. And what they found was that the more of the olive oil in the nuts that you consume, the less your risk for cancer, especially breast cancer. So, one more reason why we should be choosing a healthy plant-based diet with lots of olives and lots of nuts. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with a special, in-depth, original investigative report. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Noll for a special report. Our article is published as of now on our ProgressiveRadarNetwork.com site. It is entitled Monsanto's Sealed Documents Reveal the Truth Behind Roundup's Toxicological Dangers by Richard Gale and myself. The year 2015 has been kind to Monsanto. In March, the World Health Organization declared that the company's flagship product, its herbicide glyphosate, or Roundup, is a probable human carcinogen. Increasingly, national health ministries are taking a hard second look at glyphosate's health and environmental dangers, and efforts are underway to ban the herbicide. To protect its citizens last year, the Netherlands, Bermuda, Sri Lanka, have either banned or imposed strict limits on Roundup. Last June, France banned its use in gardens. Brazil, Germany, and Argentina are considering legislative bans. And this month, California's Environmental Protection Agency launched plans to label Roundup as a carcinogen. Glyphosate is the most widely used herbicide in the world today. Over 130 countries currently permit extensive use of the chemical. The U.S. is the largest consumer, using approximately 20% of the world's Roundup. The latest reliable figures from the U.S. Geological Survey record 280 million pounds of Roundup were used in 2012, nearly a pound for every American. In 2013, gross profit of $371 million on crop chemicals, including Roundup, climbed 73% due to a 37% increase in sales. That same year, Monsanto's net income rose 22% to $1.48 billion. Over the years, a large body of independent research has accumulated and now collectively provides a sound scientific rationale to confirm that glyphosate is far more toxic and poses more serious health risks to animals and humans than Monsanto and the U.S. government admit. Among the many diseases and health conditions, non-industry studies identified Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and autism since Roundup has been shown to instigate aluminum accumulation in the brain. The herbicide has been responsible for reproductive problems such as infertility, miscarriages, and neurotube and birth defects. It is a causal agent for a variety of cancers, including brain cancer, breast, prostate, lung, and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Other disorders include chronic kidney and liver diseases, diabetes, heart disease, hypothyroidism, and leaky gut syndrome. In addition to lung cancer, glyphosate may be responsible for today's growing epidemics of chronic respiratory illnesses among farm workers and their families. However, these findings derive from outside the big agricultural industry. Private industries routinely defend themselves by positing their own research to refute independent reports. Consequently, for several decades, it has been a he said, she said stalemate. Monsanto is content with this. It can conduct business as usual. Roundup sales increase, and the debates and media wars continue without government interference. Then who is protecting the public? Government officials and health regulators, more often than not, simply ignore these studies, even if published in peer-reviewed journals. The bulk of independently funded studies, most have been performed in foreign nations, and therefore American bias dismisses them outright. Furthermore, Monsanto and other large chemical agricultural companies are quick to counter and discredit adverse scientific findings. The company has the financial means to retain large international PR firms such as Burston Marsteller and Fleischmann Hillard, consultation firms and think tanks, as well as large armies of hired trolls and academic spokespersons to mobilize damage control upon notice and protect the integrity of Monsanto's products and public image. It funds and orchestrates self-serving research at universities and research laboratories to increase an arsenal of junk science. And of course, it has Hillary Clinton and Bill Gates as its celebrity cheerleaders. The EPA continues to align itself with Monsanto's safety claims and limits glyphosate's risks to kidney, reproductive, and carcinogenic damage. And the warning only applies for very long-term exposure to high levels of the toxin. Anything under that is considered harmless. The EPA continues to approve small amounts of glyphosate as safe in drinking water to children. Its safety level is 0.7 UG per L. This was determined back in 1994, and after 20 years of further research into glyphosate's biochemical and biomolecular activities and health risks, the level has remained the same. A review of existing data sponsored by Moms Across America found that out of 21 drinking water samples analyzed, 13 had glyphosate levels between 0.08 and 0.3 UGLs, well below the EPA's limit, but significantly above the European Union's limit of 0.1. And while the company manages to successfully dodge scientific research outside its purview, the tables would certainly turn if it could be proven in a court of law that Monsanto has known for decades that glyphosate is one of the most toxic substances ever launched on the public, which adversely affects almost every tissue and cell in a mammal's body. Imagine for a moment that evidence emerged to implicate Monsanto on a massive cover-up and manipulation of scientific data from hundreds of research trials. If it were Monsanto's data indicating that, yes, Monsanto is toxic, and if it can be shown the company's falsified, masked, or fudged its data to win regulatory approval, it may likely be the largest corporate scandal in history. The question could then be raised, is it possible for Monsanto to be charged with crimes of omission, or more deservedly, crimes against humanity? This scenario may not be fantasy or the wishful thinking of GMO opponents. The case has a precedent and has been played out in the courts before. In November 1998, the U.S. government won a judgment against the four largest tobacco companies, Philip Morris, R.J. Reynolds, Brown & Williamson, and Lorillard. The case came to trial after a former vice president of research and development at Brown & Williamson, Jeffrey Wingate, turned whistleblower and revealed that his company concealed the tobacco's health risks and was making concerted efforts to addict people to smoking. High-ranking executives were found to have approved the inclusion of known addictive and carcinogenic chemicals such as cumarin in its cigarettes to increase smoking and sales and profits. Before the trial, there had never been a lawsuit lost by a tobacco company because no one could prove with absolute medical certainty that smoking had ever caused lung cancer or emphysema. During congressional hearings, all seven CEOs representing the four tobacco giants lied under oath, stating that they had no knowledge about an association between nicotine and brain addiction. The rationale was that they believed their research data and marketing strategies were protected under proprietary secrecy claims, and therefore they could avoid conviction. Although FDA scientists possessed all the necessary information that could condemn Big Tobacco's false claims, the industry relied upon proprietary rules in order to hide behind legal protection. The FDA was silenced and powerless to make the industry's information public. Consequently, it is estimated that millions of Americans died or were injured from a risk that could have been prevented or at least reduced substantially. Instead, the FDA honored the tobacco industry and its proprietary products and secrecy above all human life. The guilty verdict, which resulted in the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement against the tobacco companies, enforced a minimum of $206 billion settlement over a 25-year period. And while the majority of payments were to settle 46 state Medicaid lawsuits to recover smoking-related health costs, the settlement unfortunately exempted the industry from private tort claims. Many critics of the amendment state that the settlement was too merciful. No tobacco executive went to prison, and evidence indicates the industry emerged stronger and consolidated the companies into an ever more powerful cartel. What busted the tobacco companies was not the scientific evidence piling up outside the industry. Rather, it was its crimes of omission about cigarettes' health risks within the industry. The industry's own research prosecuted itself, and this is demanded today in order to bring down Monsanto's chemical regime and to protect populations and children throughout the world. Perhaps we might want to consider the atmosphere Monsanto faced after its first developed glyphosate in 1973 and prepare for EPA approval for the remainder of the decade. During the latter half of the 1970s, Monsanto's leading products were under federal inquiry and public assault regarding safety. Dioxin had been banned. Safety concerns arose over the sweetener saccharin, and cyclamate was removed from the market. The company's attempts to get its new artificial sweetener aspartame confronted obstacles during FDA scientific review, and independent research had shown that aspartame caused brain tumors in mammals. And its best-selling herbicide at the time, Lasso, was showing signs of carcinogenicity. Today, Lasso is a restricted-use pesticide due to its oncogenicity. With sales falling and future growth under threat, Monsanto faced a desperate need to launch a new and novel flagship product. Monsanto found itself banking its future on its new herbicide, glyphosate. As we recently discovered, enormous amounts of research and analysis of hundreds of trials were conducted to learn as much as possible about the compound's bioactivity in mammals and its potential health risks. All of this research data, studies, and reports were substantially prevented from seeing public eye. They were subsequently sealed as trade secrets upon submission to the EPA. Hence, for over 30 years, all this data, thousands of pages, has sat protected, unseen by the scientific or lay public, in the EPA vaults. Monsanto has yet to be caught and charged for falsifying scientific data on glyphosate. However, on earlier occasions, two laboratories Monsanto outsourced research to were caught and indicted. In 1978, the EPA busted industrial biotest laboratories for rigging laboratory results. The company's executives were found guilty of submitting fabricated data supporting glyphosate positively to the government. In 1991, another firm, Craven Labs, was found guilty on similar charges with 20 felony counts. To this day, Monsanto continues to assert that Roundup is environmentally friendly. We are told it biodegrades rapidly and therefore poses no long-term risk after repeated usage. We are told that the herbicide is ideal for weed control. Throughout the U.S., it is liberally sprayed on our public parks, school playgrounds, sporting fields, and throughout our towns and on our lawns and gardens. We are told it doesn't bioaccumulate in the body's cells and tissues and excreted rapidly. We are also told that glyphosate toxicity is dose-specific. Only exceedingly high levels of the pesticide pose any serious health risks. How factual are these claims, or are they mere propaganda to obscure scientific truths far more deceptive and sinister? To answer that, we would have to know for certain whether or not Monsanto's conducted long-term studies on glyphosate that revealed devastating toxic effect on mammal health. We would need evidence that their own data clearly negates their scientific declarations, and that the company intentionally and with forethought either distorted or concealed data from federal regulatory officials and the public. There is now an enormous cache of evidence on both scientific and legal grounds that Monsanto, in fact, conducted numerous studies in the 1970s and 80s on glyphosate's toxicity and health risk and intentionally sealed this research from independent and public review and scrutiny. As with Big Tobacco's proprietary claims that prevented the FDA from publicly warning Americans about the dangers of smoking, the EPA has sat on Monsanto's own deleterious data for decades. Anthony Samsell is an independent research scientist working internationally in the interest of public health and the environment. He is a member of the Union of Concerned Scientists, a former scientist and consultant with Arthur D. Little, one of the world's leading management consulting firms. Samsell has devoted much of his independent research on Roundup's toxicological characteristics and bioactivity. Unable to gain access to research reports and data Monsanto submitted to the EPA through the Freedom of Information Act, he turned to his senator's office, who assisted in the procurement of studies and reports he sought. Months later, he received a hoard of scientific documents, over 15,000 pages worth, covering Monsanto's complete glyphosate research. With his co-investigator, Dr. Stephanie Seneff, at MIT, the two have been reviewing Monsanto's data. Their conclusion is Monsanto's claims about glyphosate safety are patently false. The company has known for almost 40 years that glyphosate is responsible for a large variety of cancers and organ failures. Clearly, it was for this reason that Monsanto demanded the data and reports be sealed and hidden from public scrutiny as proprietary trade secrets. During an exclusive interview on the Progressive Radio Network, on September 4, Samsell stated that Monsanto used an industry trick to dismiss evidence about glyphosate's risks in its own research. Quote, Monsanto misrepresented the data and deliberately covered up data to bring the product glyphosate to market. In order to minimize and cancel out its adverse findings, Samsell explained that Monsanto had relied upon earlier historical animal control data, toxicological research with lab animals afflicted with cancer and organ failures, and completely unrelated to glyphosate. In some cases, the control animals displayed kidney, liver, and pancreatic diseases. Many of Monsanto's own studies required the inclusion of extraneous studies in order to correct and cancel out damaging results. This is not an uncommon industry habit, particularly in toxicological science. It enables corporations to mask undesirable outcomes and make claims that observable illnesses and diseases are spontaneous occurrences without known causal factors. Frequently, Monsanto would have to rely upon three external control studies to negate the adverse effects of a single one of its own. Samsell found other incidences of Monsanto's data where 5, 7, or in one case 11 unrelated studies were necessary to diminish the severity of its own findings. In effect, glyphosate received licensure based upon a platform of junk tobacco science. By ignoring cause and effect relationships behind the onset of multiple cancers and other life-threatening diseases throughout many of its research trials, Monsanto engaged in a radical scientific denialism that has since raked in tens of billions of dollars in profits. But the cache of Monsanto documents after Samsell and Dr. Seneff's review reveal much more that we should be worried about. In addition, Monsanto's studies included doses from low to high range. Samsell observed that low glyphosate doses were equally, if not more, toxic than higher doses. The company later discontinued low-dose trials, relying only on higher levels because it is customarily assumed to have greater toxicological risk. Samsell's observation has recently been confirmed by a study published in the August issue of the Environmental Health Journal by scientists at King's College London and the University of Caen in France. The two-year study found that glyphosate administered at ultra-low levels of 0.1 0.1 parts per billion, the European Union's safety limit in drinking water, altered over 4,000 gene clusters in the liver and kidneys of rats. These alterations, the study reports, quote, were consistent with fibrosis, necrosis, phospholipidosis, mitochondrial membrane dysfunction, and ischemia, end quote. Consequently, low doses of Roundup are far more toxic than U.S. EPA limits. During its years investigating glyphosate's bioactivity, Monsanto conducted hundreds of trials on mice, rats, beagles, dogs, rabbits, and other life. Among the many cancers and diseases Monsanto's own research found associated with glyphosate are adenocarcinoma in the pituitary gland, glioma brain tumors, cancers of sarcoma in the heart, malignant tumors in the lungs, salivary mandibular rectilar cell carcinoma, metastatic carcinomas of the lymph glands, prostate carcinoma, cancer of the bladder, thyroid carcinoma, adrenal rectilium cell sarcomas, cortical adenomas, basal cell squamous cell skin tumors. In female mammals, there were cancers of the lung, liver, thymus, stomach, bladder, adrenal glands, ovaries, colon, uterus, parathyroid, and mammary glands. Samsel and Dr. Senefef also announced and noticed that Monsanto had conducted many long-term studies, as much as 2 years, on mice and rats. When Dr. Seralini and his French team reproduced and extended the length of Monsanto's 3-month GMO maize rat-fed study for the life of the animals, they observed profuse cancer and tumor development started after month 4 of the study. Monsanto continues to stand by its 3-month study as sufficient proof of GM's maize safety. Yet the thoroughness and variety of Monsanto's research operations should give strong reason to suspect that Monsanto has likewise conducted long-term studies and knows all too well the deleterious effects of its pesticides, herbicides, and genetically modified crops. One of Monsanto's claims is that glyphosate doesn't bioaccumulate in tissues, rapidly biodegrades, and is excreted from the body's cells. Contrary to this claim, Monsanto carried out meticulous studies to determine levels of accumulation in the organs, tissues, and cell glyphosate researches. Glyphosate was radio-labeled with carbon-14 and given in 10 milligram doses to 7 groups of animals, male and female. After only 24 hours, the toxic chemical was found in the lungs and all body fluids, the lymph, the blood, the urine, and the cerebral spinal fluid. Glyphosate also accumulated in the bone by 20 parts per million and in the bone marrow at 4 parts per million. Monsanto's studies were comprehensive. It found an accumulation of the chemical in red cells, thyroid, uterus, colon, testes, and ovaries, shoulder muscle, nasal mucosa, heart, lungs, small intestine, abdominal muscle, and the eyes. Samsel and Senefef noted that the bioaccumulation in the pancreas was not reported. Why would such meticulous efforts be made to measure radio-labeled carbon-14-laced glyphosate levels in all other organs, tissues, and body fluids, and then ignore the pancreas? The scientists believe this was deliberate. Samsel notes that glyphosate does a, quote, particular number on the lungs. According to a 2014 report by the National Cancer Institute, lung cancer rates have been declining. The decline is largely due to the national decrease in smoking. However, other lung cancers, such as adenocarcinomas, are on the rise. The National Cancer Institute is unable to account for this anomaly. Yet the Institute is not considering that Americans are increasingly being exposed to glyphosate in their food, water, and environment. During our interview, Dr. Senef stated that the pancreas may be driving glyphosate to gather in the lungs. The pancreas is responsible for the release of the enzyme trypsin, which in turn infiltrates the lungs. A study published by Brazil's University and Federal Santa Maria in the journal their official journal measured glyphosate's reactivity with digestive enzymes, including trypsin. And trypsin activity was found to increase in parallel to higher glyphosate concentration. Dr. Senef suggests that this may be contributing to the increase in glyphosate in the lungs that is contributing to the dramatic increase in COPD and asthma conditions, as well as lung cancers. The accuracy of these is still to be checked. However, the occurrences of cataracts is rising rapidly, particularly in Midwestern states such as North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, Kansas, and Missouri. According to a Prevent Blindness America statistic, 17% of adults over 40 have cataract problems. The National Institutes of Health projects the rate will reach nearly 40% in the next 15 years. Monsanto's study showing glyphosate activity in the eye may be contributing to this epidemic. Dr. Senefus stated that the eye's exposure to sunlight reacts with glyphosate residues, thereby potentially making the chemical more toxic. Farmers often apply glyphosate on crops when it is warm, moist, and when there is plenty of sunlight in order for the chemical to activate more effectively. These are similar conditions to our eyes during the day. Monsanto's research was not limited solely to the Roundup compound. It also performed extensive research on glyphosate's individual metabolites, the intermediate molecules that result after Roundup's breakdown through metabolic reactions. Many of these metabolites are every bit as toxic as glyphosate. All the glyphosate metabolites in solution fed to rats were measured before and after feeding. One of Sam Sell's more disturbing discoveries was that levels of the metabolite in nitrosoglyphosate, NNG, were found in a higher concentration in the rat feces and urine excretions than the original amount in the feeding solutions. NNG is a known carcinogen and endocrine disruptor. Sam Sells postulates that our own body's natural nitrous acid reacts immediately with glyphosate without requiring a catalyst to produce NNG. Both the EPA and the World Health Organization acknowledge that NNG is present in glyphosate during the manufacturing process. The agencies therefore have established safety limits for NNG. However, for any endocrine disruptor, there is no realistic safe limit because such chemical disruptors destroy cells on a molecule-to-molecule basis. Nitrous acid naturally occurs in the colon, urinary tract, and skin tissue. According to the CDC, skin cancer is the most common form of cancer in the United States and affects more men than women. The Skin Cancer Foundation estimates that, quote, each year there are more new skin cancer cases than the combined incidence of cancer of the breast, prostate, lung, and colon, end quote. Basal cell and squamous cell carcinomas are the two most common forms, both of which have been identified by Monsanto with glyphosate exposure, particularly in males. When glyphosate reacts in the skin along with nitrous acid, the metabolites NNG contributes to skin melanomas. Other chemicals are added to Monsanto's Roundup to increase its effectiveness, such as the surfactant PQEA, and which also increases its toxicity. We don't pay enough attention to these other ingredients, Samsell states, because the EPA permits Monsanto to add anything it wants to enhance Roundup's potency while identifying these substances as innocuous, as inert. When Monsanto convinced the public that glyphosate breaks down quickly, we are not told that the compound's metabolic byproducts are equally toxic. In conclusion, therefore, Anthony Samsell's unprecedented discovery and review of Monsanto's actual scientific and toxicological data of Roundup has provided us with information that warrants a thoughtful pause. Samsell and Dr. Senefe cover the subject in more detail in a new peer-reviewed paper entitled Glyphosate Pathways to Modern Disease, Part 4, Cancer and Related Pathologies. The paper has been approved for publication next month. During recent years, dozens of states have submitted bills to label GMO foods. These food crops are heavily laced with glyphosate residue. Not only GM crops, but even non-GM produce are sprayed with Roundup. According to the Organic Consumer Association, non-organic and non-GMO foods such as wheat, barley, oats, flax, peas, lentils, beans, and sugarcane are also being sold to Monsanto, quote, as a product to be used. Monsanto, DuPont, Syngenta, Grocery Manufacturers of America, and other agrochemical companies are aggressively combating labeling efforts. The big ag lobby is today pushing for a national bill to prevent GMO labeling that would supersede individual states' rights. We can only wonder what the voting outcome in California, Colorado, Washington, Oregon may have been had Monsanto's own research been made available to the media and the public. It is therefore not time for full congressional hearings to learn the truth once and for all, and to have full disclosure of all of Monsanto's Roundup research made to the public. And our article is fully referenced. I'm Gary Nall, and that will be followed by another article in the near future. Let us now go to our conference call. We're standing by is Gerald Salante, one of today's pioneers in trend strategy and the founding member of the Trends Research Institute in Kingston, New York. He is a publisher of the Trends Journal, which has been published since 1980. And he's become one of the nation's most sought-after diagnosticians and forecasters. He is joined by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, one of today's most progressive political and economic writers and commentators on the state of the nation and government dysfunction, political corruption, global and domestic economic threats. And they're both here to discuss Occupy Peace. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thank you.
Let's start with you, Gerald. Hello, Gerald?
Hello, I'm here.
Good. If any kind of change to occur in the country, it's going to have to be from an upswelling of citizen participation and self-organizing rather than putting too much focus and effort into believing the system can be reformed and changed from within. And two parties right now are too incorrigible and corrupt, I believe, to be reformed or redeemed. And for the last federal budget, the military and defense spending will increase by $483 billion. The actual figure now is closer to $610 billion. That does not include all the other offline budgets, bring it over to over $1 trillion. So trillions in defense budget have not been accounted for or seemingly lost or disappeared based upon Rumsfeld's own omission before Congress and around 9/11. And when we combine defense spending of China, Russia, Saudi Arabia, France, and the United Kingdom, India, and Germany, it totals about $600 billion, which is less than the United States. So clearly neither domestic nor global peace can ever be attained if the U.S. is determined to be the global police force by militaristic means. So take us through step by step what you hope will be achieved with Occupy Peace and to make a difference.
Well, we're launching it, of course, this coming weekend, and you'll be there, and Ralph Nader and Cindy Sheehan and Dr. Robert Thurman, Uma Thurman's father, who's a very vocal peace activist. And Dr. Paul Craig Roberts wrote a piece recently. He said, "Fight for peace, not for war." And that commentators were saying that the peace movement is dead, but that we're reviving it. And what makes Occupy Peace different than any other movement, it's an action plan for peace. You said earlier, to paraphrase you, that both parties are corrupt, political parties, and you can't reform them, or words to that effect. I look at the Republicans and Democrats no different than the Bloods and the Crips, and I don't say that sarcastically. They've killed how many millions of people in the name of freedom and democracy, and now under Obama and his staff of other war hawks, including Susan Rice, Samantha Powers, and Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State. They do it for humanitarian reasons, as they did with the destabilization of Libya by overthrowing a sovereign nation that was run by Gaddafi, and as they're doing now in Syria. And as the United States is also part of it, as they're bombing Yemen on a daily basis through Saudi Arabia. And the United States, of course, is part of that. So, and when I say murderers, it's right there in front of everybody's eyes, drone strikes and on and on. And when I say thieves, how much more of our money do they have to steal in the name of too big to fails, tax breaks, loan guarantees, etc.? So to me, anyone that supports those parties are accomplices to murder and theft. What Occupy Peace does, it's a program. We're launching it from Colonial Kingston, the most historic four corners, the only place on each corner where there's a pre-Revolutionary War stone building. To honor thy founding fathers, we could all say the terrible things about America, but we also have to look at the positive things, and one of them was the Constitution, 90% of which was taken from the New York State Constitution, which was written right here at the courthouse location when Kingston was the first capital of New York State. And beginning with George Washington, his farewell address, no foreign entanglements. And this is a real warrior. This is a guy that led the troops, not these little boys that play pool, shoot hoops, drive pickup trucks, and play golf. No foreign entanglements, Franklin, Adams, Jefferson. So the first plank of Occupy Peace is close the bases overseas, bring home the troops, put them to work rebuilding our rotted infrastructure, WPA program, rather than building highways around Afghanistan, Iraq, and other nations we invade, occupy, and destroy. The next element is that Congress has not voted to go to war since World War II. They give the power to the president. This is not what this nation was founded upon. But, of course, they roll out red carpets for the presidents and everybody salutes. We've gone back to a royalty. So demand that Congress vote anytime we're in a foreign entanglement, as we are now back in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Yemen, and in Syria. And finally, being that we the people pay for the war with our money and our lives, we are demanding to have on each state we're working toward a referendum, a ballot, where we the people will tell Congress how to vote when they're ready to vote to go to war. Because, number one, Congress does not represent us. Everybody knows who they represent. They represent the people that give them the most amount of campaign money. And number two is that they are not the ones that fight the war, not the senator's sons. We're the ones that pay for the war with our money and our lives. So we're going to have referendums on each state ballot that we the people will tell Congress how to vote, a direct democracy.
Well, Gerald, let's do this because we're running out of time. Give people information how to get there, when it's going to happen, where it's going to happen, so they can sign up and join us.
Go to the website OccupyPeace.us, OccupyPeace.us, this Sunday, high noon, at the most historic four corners in the United States, OccupyPeace.us, to bring peace and prosperity back to America.
So they can watch it from anywhere in the world?
Well, they won't be able to watch it from anywhere in the world, but they could attend the rally. The rally's open, it's free. The mayor has given us permission to close down the streets.
Okay, now,
I'm
coming up on Saturday morning early, so we're also doing it Saturday, right?
Well, we're having a conference. This is the pre-conference to the rally, where you'll be speaking at, Dr. Prolkeg Roberts and others. And that rally, you could find out more about the conference by going to our website, trendsresearch.com.
And Ralph Nader's going to be there.
Ralph Nader, you, Cindy Sheehan at the rally, and Dr. Robert Thurman.
And then on Saturday and Sunday, up in Kingston, which is close to Woodstock, it's only about an hour and 50 minutes to 2 hours from New York City. And so it's really exciting. It's historic. It's a real viable movement where we're going to get something done. And that's why I'm joining it, and I look forward to being there this Saturday and Sunday for the conference and then the rally, Kingston. And give the website again, please.
OccupyPeace.us, and for the conference, our website is trendsresearch.com, and just click on the conference information.
Gerald, thank you very much. I look forward to being able to speak with Dr. Paul Craig Roberts and Ralph Nader and Cindy Sheehan and Dr. Thurman, who I filmed last year, all up there this weekend. So we start a major movement, Occupy Peace, and we'll get stuff done. Have a nice day, everyone. Thank you all for listening. Mm-hmm.